From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, actress Ellen Burstyn. She's up for her second Academy Award for her role in Requiem for a Dream. She received her first for the 1974 film Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, which she got Martin Scorsese to direct. She played the mother in The Exorcist, which was re-released last year. Also, Tejano singer Ruben Ramos on blending traditional Mexican music, the big band sound, and rhythm and blues. He leads his own band and is a member of the Grammy Award-winning all-star band Los Super 7. And Maureen Corrigan reviews Seabiscuit, an American legend, a biography of the famous racehorse. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Federal Reserve's Open Market Committee has trimmed a key short-term lending rate by 0.5%. The move was widely anticipated, and it did little to boost spirits on Wall Street. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
The announcement from the Fed that it was cutting the target for the federal funds rate by 0.5% was in line with analysts' expectations. However, the buzz had been growing on financial markets in recent days that perhaps the Fed might impose a larger rate cut. When that didn't happen, the Dow fell more than 200 points. Steve Ricciuto, chief economist with ABN AMRO, says with the latest action by the Fed, short-term rates have now declined by 1.5% since the start of the year.
These guys are not of a mind to run out after having cut interest rates 100 basis points in January and cutting 150 basis points in a quarter to think they haven't been aggressive.
Still aggressive may have been exactly what Wall Street was pinning its hopes on. For consumers, the news was a little better after the announcement several big banks cut their prime lending rates to 8%. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
President Bush has signed a measure that repeals ergonomic work rules that were put in place during the final days of the Clinton administration. The work rules were designed to reduce repetitive motion injuries such as carpal tunnel syndrome. Business groups opposed the rules, saying they'd be far too expensive to implement. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration said the rules would save far more money than they cost by preventing injuries and lost productivity. As he signed the repeal legislation today, the president said he considered the rules to be unduly burdensome and overly broad. The FBI has quietly changed its policy on polygraphs and tightened up restrictions on the people who have access to information. The move comes after it was revealed that Robert Hansen, who's accused of spying for Moscow, never took a polygraph. NPR's Barbara Bradley reports.
In the past, the only people who received polygraphs were job applicants, agents on the most secret investigations, and those already suspected of wrongdoing. But last Friday, FBI Director Louis Freeh changed the policy. According to a law enforcement source, all FBI officials with wide-ranging access to information, such as systems administrators, will be routinely polygraphed. That means an additional 500 to 600 people will be covered. The bigger change has to do with audits. Now the FBI will regularly monitor the computer trail of agents who have access to national security information. If it appears that an agent is looking at information that he or she does not need to have, that will raise a red flag and the Bureau will investigate. Barbara Bradley, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 238 points, or 2.4%, to close at 9,721. The blue chip is now down more than 17% from its high in January of last year. The NASDAQ lost 94 points. This is NPR. Power managers in California say it still may be necessary to call for rolling power outages this evening. Earlier today, the lights went out in various areas on a rotating basis for more than 4 hours after officials declared a Stage 3 power alert. They said the emergency was triggered by a boost in demand as the weather turned warm and people turned on their air conditioners. At the same time, energy supplies from the Northwest were short and some California plants were taken offline for repairs. NASA has put off the landing of the Space Shuttle Discovery. The threat of winds and clouds as well as rain will push the landing back to 2:30 tomorrow morning at the earliest. Pat Duggins reports from member station WMFE.
NASA has two landings. landing sites for the space shuttle, one in Florida and a backup site at Edwards Air Force Base in California. The weather looks bad in Florida and good at Edwards for the overnight landing, now set for 2:30 a.m. Eastern Time. Forecasters say the weather gets slightly better in Florida tomorrow night, but it's worse in California. That leaves NASA with the option of abandoning a Florida landing altogether and going for the backup site where conditions are favorable. The shuttle has enough supplies on board to last until Friday. The seven men aboard the spacecraft includes the first three-man permanent crew to work aboard the International Space Station. Bill Shepard, Yuri Gutsenko, and Sergei Krikalev spent close to 5 months aboard the orbiting outpost. Two astronauts and a cosmonaut took over as the permanent crew on the station. For NPR News, I'm Pat Duggins in Orlando.
Artillery fire has stopped booming in the hills outside the Macedonian city of Tetovo, where government troops are fighting a band of ethnic Albanian rebels. The military threatened a full-scale assault if the rebels don't stop fighting within 24 hours. Earlier today, the rebels called for negotiations. Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of all-natural vitamin E. ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Ellen Burstyn is having one of her best years professionally at an age when many actresses have difficulty even finding work. She's in her late 60s. Burstyn has been nominated for an Oscar in the Best Actress category for her role in the independent film Requiem for a Dream. In the past year, she also co-starred with Mark Wahlberg and Joaquin Phoenix in the movie The Yards, and her 1973 film The Exorcist was re-released. She's now co-starring in the CBS series That's Life. Let's start with a clip from Requiem for a Dream. She plays an aging mother who hasn't figured out that her son is a drug addict. She stays home all day watching TV and eating chocolates, habits that are responsible for a big weight gain. But after she gets a call saying that she's been chosen to be a contestant on her favorite game show, she goes on a diet with the help of amphetamines, which she becomes addicted to without realizing she has a problem. But her son, who has plenty of drug experience, knows she has a problem. In this scene, he tells her she's strung out and needs to quit.
Oh, come on. I almost fit in my red dress. The one I wore to your high school graduation, the one your father liked so much. Oh, I remember how he looked at me in that red dress.
Mama, what's the big deal about the red dress?
I'm gonna wear it. You don't know. I'm gonna be on television. I got a call and an application and...
Come on, Ma. Who's pulling your leg?
No. I'm telling you, I'm going to be a contestant on television. I don't know when yet. They haven't told me when yet. But you'll see how proud you are when you see your mother in a red dress, television, and golden shoes.
What is the big deal about being on television? Those pills you're taking will kill you before you ever get on, for Christ's sake.
Big deal? You drove up in a cab. Did you see who had the best seat? I'm somebody now, Harry. Everybody likes me. Soon, millions of people will see me and they'll all like me. I'll tell them about you, your father, how good he was to us. Remember? It's a reason to get up in the morning.
Ellen Burstyn, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
What are some of the emotional and physical changes that were most difficult for you during the making of Requiem for a Dream?
Well, the physical changes, Sarah loses 50 pounds during the course of the film, and we accomplished that with a 40-pound fat suit and then a 20-pound fat suit with accompanying necks, which were glued on and horrible to get off. It took about an hour to peel off, and my skin absorbed all of the glue, and then we had to use hot towels to bring the glue up to the surface, and my skin turned bright red and actually bled sometimes. It was just a nightmare. And then once we got out of the fat suits, fortunately there was a two-week break in the schedule, so I was able to take off 10 of my own pounds. So, you know, just accomplishing that was always difficult and uncomfortable. The fat suits were hot and it was hot weather, and so it was just, I was in a state of high discomfort for most of the shooting.
Ellen Burstyn, this has really been your year. You have an Academy Award nomination for Requiem for a Dream. You're in a TV series on CBS. You're within the past year, your movie The Yards came out. The Exorcist that you starred in was re-released. Did you ever expect this kind of activity, particularly in your late 60s?
No, I never expected it at all. I'm having the busiest year of my life. Right after the awards, I'm going to Montreal to make a film for Lifetime that I sold to them and had written for me, called Their Last Chance, which will be set in a prison. And then I go to North Carolina in May and June to do The Divine Secrets of the Yah-Yah Sisterhood, which is a fabulous book by Rebecca Wells, and the screenplay is just even more wonderful. I don't know quite what change in the heavens occurred, but I'm receiving all these wonderful blessings and enjoying it and feel grateful.
Let me take you back to one of your first big films, and this was from, I think, 1973. And this is The Exorcist, which was re-released with a new print last year. I should mention, you play the mother. You play, you know, an actress who learns that her daughter seems to be going crazy and then ends up, it turns out, being possessed by the devil.
Mm-hmm. By a demon.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Let me play a short clip from the film. In this scene, you've walked into your daughter's bedroom. She's stabbing her genitals with a crucifix while saying obscenities about Jesus. You struggle to get the crucifix away from her. She slaps you and knocks you across the room. As you lie on the floor, a dresser at the end of the other end of the room starts rolling toward you while your daughter turns her head around 360 degrees. Let's hear the scene. Ellen Burstyn, did you practice screaming a lot for this and trying to figure out, like, which kind of scream should I use?
Well, I was so in those scenes that whatever came out, came out. You kind of can't chart your screams ahead of time. Those were frightening and horrendous scenes to play, and it wasn't really difficult to scream. That must sound weird on radio without any images.
So you said that these scenes were very emotionally intense, so screaming came easy. Tell me about shooting the scene that we just heard.
Well, that was a difficult scene for me. I was wearing a rig around my midriff, and I had a wire attached to it, and the stuntman pulled me to the floor when Linda hit me. And I really should have had padding on the floor, and I didn't, unfortunately, because it did injure my back, which I'm still struggling with. That's become kind of part of my life, that scene you played for me. We got through it, and I screamed, for sure.
Was the final take in the movie the take in which you injured your back?
Yeah. Oh, I couldn't work after that. I was really badly injured. As a matter of fact, the next 2 weeks or 3 weeks, I was on crutches and just put them down when I went in to do a scene, and then picked them up again as soon as I finished with a take.
What happened? Did you fracture a bone?
I didn't break anything. I just badly bruised my coccyx, and there's a lot of scar tissue formed, which is the the result now of that injury, but I didn't break anything, no.
Did you sue or anything like that or consider?
No, I probably should have. If I had realized how, you know, that it was going to be a problem for the rest of my life, I might have, but I didn't realize that at the time. I thought it was a wound I would get over and heal. But recently when I was working with Charlize Theron on The Yards, and she was doing a scene where she was knocked down the stairs and she was getting pretty banged up, I cautioned her to not be so generous with her wounds, that they can linger and scar tissue can be formed and she can have trouble later in life. A lesson I learned the hard way.
My guest is Ellen Burstyn. She is nominated for an Academy Award for her performance in the independent film Requiem for a Dream. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Ellen Burstyn is my guest. She's nominated for an Academy Award for Best Actress for her role in the movie Requiem for a Dream. Let me ask you about your 1974 film, Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore. In this, you play a woman who has a troubled relationship with her husband, but then her husband dies in a car crash. And the woman and her son are left penniless. She decides to leave home, take off for the road, and try to make it as a singer, an ambition that she always had. You're the one who discovered the script and got this produced. You got Martin Scorsese to direct it. How did you find the script, and why were you so enthusiastic about it?
I was shooting The Exorcist at the time, and John Calley was running Warner Brothers then, and he sent me a message, because he was looking at the dailies every day, that he would like to do another film with me, and he started sending me all of the scripts that they owned. And this was right at the beginning of the women's movement, and I was very aware of how women were depicted on the screen. And all of these scripts were kind of a man's eye view of a woman. And I wanted to tell a story from a woman's point of view. So my agent found this script written by Bob Getchell, and I really liked it. I thought it was a wonderful script. And I told Warners I wanted to do it, and they agreed. And then they asked me who I wanted to direct it. And I said, somebody new and exciting and wonderful. And so I called Francis Coppola, and I asked him who's new, exciting, and wonderful. And he said, well, look at a film called Mean Streets, Marty's first film, which hadn't been released yet. And so I looked at that, and I liked it, and Marty and I met. And then we did the film together, and he was a wonderful director to work with. And I would say he's a wonderful collaborator. And together we did something that hadn't been done for maybe ever, which is really tell the story from the woman's point of view.
It's funny that you would ask Scorsese to direct a movie from a woman's point of view, since he's such a quintessential guy director, particularly Mean Streets. It's about, you know, these two men who have this inseparable relationship.
Yeah, well, when I met with Marty, I said, it's hard to tell from Mean Streets if you know anything about women, do you? And he said, no, but I'd like to learn. And I thought that was as good a response as one could ever hoped for. And I think he probably did.
Were there questions he asked you, you know, to get insights into what a woman's point of view might be?
The only one that I remember, we wanted to do a scene where Alice falls in love with the Kris Kristofferson character. And I said, you know, let's show a woman falling in love. So we talked about how that could be visualized, and I said, well, I always get turned on watching men work, so could we have a scene where he's hammering something or, you know, working physically. So Marty designed the scene where he's out repairing a fence and I'm standing and watching him. And you can kind of see when you see the film, you see her fall in love then. And that's what I mean by telling a story from a woman's point of view. It's not something a man would know or think of.
You won an Oscar for your role in Alice, but you didn't make it to the Oscar night ceremonies. You were starring in a play in New York same time next year on Broadway. Do you have any regrets that you chose to do your performance on Broadway instead of accepting your Oscar in person?
Well, it's part of my training, really, to value the work itself more than the rewards that come from the work. And I would have not really have been true to myself if I had walked out on my work to go accept an award. So, you know, I'm sorry I wasn't there to enjoy it, but I probably would do the same thing again if I were working in a play. I wouldn't walk out on it to go get an award.
You were in your early 40s by the time you made The Exorcist, and Alice doesn't live here anymore. What impact did it have on you to start becoming better known when you were pretty mature, as opposed to in your 20s when you were playing, you know, like the leading lady?
Well, I had had time to kind of stabilize my emotional life. I don't know if anybody who hasn't gone through fame can really appreciate what a huge blast it is to your life. Everything changes, and you have so much to handle that you never thought you would have to handle. I remember one time talking to Alan Alda about this when we were doing the film same time next year, and he said, you know, there are no class. You can take classes in becoming an actor, but you can't take a class in becoming a movie star. And we then mused on the idea of starting consciousness-raising classes for movie stars because nothing prepares you for it, you know. The amount of attention and demands and requests and energy that comes into your life that eats up every moment of your life so that you don't really have time to just sit and be yourself and think about what's happening to you. It's a lot. I know when it happened to me when I was in my 40s, I had had a little better ability to handle it just because I was older and I'd had more experience. But even so, it was a surprising turn of events and one that took more energy and more stability than I could ever have imagined.
Ellen Burstyn is my guest, and she's nominated for an Academy Award for Best Actress for her role in Requiem for a Dream. I'm so used to seeing you play a mother in movies, often a long-suffering mother, that I was surprised to read that you, very early in your career, were in a chorus line in a Montreal club. Did you have to do high kicks and all that stuff?
I was a pretty good dancer, yeah. I don't remember how many actual high kicks we had. But, you know, we had very beautiful dance numbers. And I think three dance numbers I did. But I didn't do that for very long. I started modeling right after that and became pretty successful as a model. So,
what kind of clothes?
I didn't model clothes so much as I posed for illustrators for magazines, you know, that illustrated stories and pocketbook covers. And I was kind of the top illustrators model in New York for a few years.
Now, you left home at the age of 17. Why did you leave home?
I was actually 18. I set out to see the world. I wanted to see as much of the world as I could possibly see. And I grew up in Detroit, and I'd never been outside of Detroit. And I wanted to see what the rest of the world was like. And I thought I should see the rest of my own country first. So I I set out for Texas and started my career there modeling.
Did you do anything when you were a teenager after leaving home and setting out to see the world that in retrospect seems to you to be incredibly foolish or naive or dangerous?
Well, when I left Detroit, I left on a Greyhound bus and I headed for Dallas. And when I got there, I just had enough. I didn't even have enough money to eat. I got there, checked into a hotel, and didn't have enough money to pay the bill, but just felt sure that I would get a job and be able to pay the bill by the end of the week. And ran out of food money before I did get a job. So I went a few days without eating. Three. And I don't think I would do that today. I can't imagine. When I think about it now, I think I was either very naive or very foolish or very brave or a little bit of each. But to move to a new city with no money in your pocket and not enough food to eat is, I would say, a pretty dangerous thing for a young girl to do.
And the job that bailed you out was?
I got a job modeling in the wholesale market.
Mm-hmm.
The wholesale market was coming to town, and the sellers hired local models, and I got a job. But I was just about to be locked out of my hotel room. I just got an advance on my salary in time to pay the bill.
So you're nominated for an Academy Award. I imagine this time around you'll be at the ceremony. You weren't there when you won for Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Will you be going with the idea that you've won, or do you think it's better off to think that you haven't won, so you'll be pleased if you do win but not disappointed if you don't?
My task is to just be in the moment, to be glad that I'm there, and to be unattached to the results. I mean, that's what the Buddha tells us, that you do your work with full commitment and passion, and you're unattached to the results. Whatever happens is what is meant to happen, and to be okay with that. So that's what I'll be doing. I'll try and be there and be okay with whatever happens.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Ellen Burstyn is nominated for an Academy Award for her role in Requiem for a Dream. She's one of the stars of the CBS series That's Life. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House Incorporated's Bantam Books Division, publisher of Folly, a novel by Laurie R. King, the author of A Darker Place. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, singer Ruben Ramos. He leads his own Tejano band and is a member of the Grammy Award-winning all-star band Los Super 7. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews a new biography of the racehorse Seabiscuit.
Desde amarillo, lo bocchio besa. Esos son los pueblos de las tierras planas. Son las tierras brutas donde ha trabajado mi padre muy duro, sembrando algodón. Si son pueblos grandes o pueblos chiquitos, gentes inmigrantes que vienen del sur, buscando trabajo, piscando algodón, también si se puede, trabajo asador. Es gente inmigrante, vive.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Ruben Ramos is one of the stars of Tejano music. He blends traditional Mexican music with jazz and rhythm and blues. He comes from a family of musicians. His uncles formed a band in 1919. Ruben's sister joined the band as a singer in 1947. His older brother formed a band in the mid-50s, which is where Ruben got his start. As a child, he was a migrant farm worker with his siblings and parents. Ruben Ramos formed his own band, the Mexican Revolution, in the late 60s. He later changed the name of the band to the Texas Revolution. He's in the Tejano Music Hall of Fame and has received multiple Tejano Music Awards. He's also a member of the Grammy Award-winning all-star group Los Super 7, which also includes two members of Los Lobos, Raul Malo of the Mavericks, and Brazilian singer Caetano Veloso. Los Super 7 has a new CD. Here's a track with Ruben Ramos singing lead.
Ay Dios, compa y gato, cuántas veces me ha dicho el muy sinvergüenza, ay de mi compa, ay lo voy a matar.
¿Por qué?
Por decirme gato, ya que gato encerrado, y ahora mismo en el acto, te lo voy a explicar. El gato caza el ratón se come el queso lo da la leche la da la vaca tiene dos cuernos, tú ves.
¡Ay, ay!
Lo mato.
¡Ay, ay!
Lo mato.
¿Por qué? ¿Por qué? ¿Por qué?
Por decirme. Ay, que yo lo digo.
That's Ruben Ramos from the new Los Super 7 CD. Ruben Ramos, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry. It's great to be here.
Before you were born, you had 10 uncles who played in a band together.
Right.
How did they all get to be musicians?
They got to be musicians by a tutor that my grandfather hired from Austin. He wanted to teach his sons, you know, some kind of culture, you know, teach him, you know, how to read and write. But it happens that the tutor that he hired was also a music teacher, you know. So he got them to play different instruments, you know. You play this, you play that, you play the trombone, you play the saxophone, and so forth. By the time you know it, they formed a band, an orchestra out of the things. But then they moved to the big city, and that's when they really took off with the orchestra.
And they first formed their band in, I think it was 1919.
1919, right. Mm-hmm.
Now, when you were growing up, your family did migrant farm work, and
that's
the work you had to do as a child. How come your father had so many brothers who were in this band together, but your father wasn't in the band? Did he learn to play music at the same time that they did?
Well, my father was in the family indirectly. You know, he's an orphan from Mexico, stolen from Mexico into the United States, you know, because his father and his mother were killed when he was 4 years old. So he was stolen to Mexico. And the family and the Perez family, which are my uncles, they knew each other, and they were from Mexico too, you know, this other family. So that brought my father from Mexico.
You were 9 years old when you first heard your uncle's band. Do you remember what they were wearing, and do you remember how they sounded, what the experience was like for you?
As far as everybody wore basically, you know, normal, except for two uncles. They were always sharp, and they were the band leaders. I remember my uncle, Justin Perez, would man from his shoes to his hat, like in the winter, with an overcoat decked out. Everything's pressed, everything is in place, and everything. Those two guys, I think, and I guess it's true, I think that's where I get my taste of, I love clothes.
Yeah,
love,
you wear some very fine clothes.
I love to wear good clothes, and I think that's where I got it from my those two uncles.
Maybe you got tired of the clothes you had to wear as a migrant worker, too, huh?
Well, that too. That too, when you had to wear over there, had to wear a pair of pants for 4 days, you know.
What kind of fruit and vegetables did you pick?
Well, sweet potatoes, onions, green beans, cucumbers, corn, okra.
What part of the country?
Cotton. Mostly in Texas. Then we go to Sheboygan, Wisconsin, and then going up to outside of Minneapolis, Minnesota, pick cucumbers, and pick apples like cherries, and, you know, but mostly the majority of the times it was picking cotton or chopping cotton.
Let's take a break here and listen to a recording from your band. And this is called Como Un Spiro. Since this is going to be in Spanish, tell us something about what the lyric says.
Como un suspiro is, a sigh. And what this song says is that life is just like a sigh. It's here and it's gone. So we need to enjoy life every day to the fullest, you know, because tomorrow might be gone, you know.
Okay.
Basically, that's what it says.
This is Ruben Ramos from his CD, El Gato Negro Smooth. That's singer Ruben Ramos, and he's also featured on a new CD by the group Los Super 7. Now, how did you know that you could sing? I mean, when you were with your family, traveling around the country, picking fruit and vegetables and cotton, did you sing in the fields? Did you have any idea you had a voice?
No. Never even an inkling that I would be singing or anything. But there was a lot of music, you know, the troquero. We travel in a truck, you know, a truck and a big bobtail truck, and all the families get up in the back and stand up and go to wherever field we're going. The truck would park, the doors open, and the radio was, you know, you hear a lot of Spanish music going on, you know, every day.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I never imagined me being a singer, you know.
My guest, the singer Ruben Ramos, we'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is singer Ruben Ramos. He leads his own band, The Texas Revolution, and he's in the all-star band Los Super 7, which has a new CD called Canto. You actually started off playing drums before you became
Yes.
a singer. You played drums in your brother's band.
Right.
Did he just ask you to learn drums because he needed a drummer, or had you already known how to play?
No, I didn't know how to play. You know, like I said, as soon as I could get away and get away with, you know, like my mom, now you can't go. But I would sneak away anyway and wind up with my brothers and all that, you know, with the orchestra. And I would get up on stage, and I couldn't get up on stage and just stand up there and be a totem pole. So I'd you know, on boleros, grab the maracas, grab the claves, grab the güiro, grab something, you know. And as I went along with him, you know, he had another drummer, and the drummer had loved to drink, you know, and would sometimes have to go to the restroom and whatever. Hey, why don't you play this waltz? Play this waltz, it's easy, like, so I could do that. So that's where I started, and then by the time, you know, he had me playing a polka because he wanted to go dance with a beautiful girl or whatever. So I wind up playing a polka, and by the time, you know, I knew two different rhythms. By the time, you know, I was playing a mambo. And by the time you know it, he missed a lot of, you know. I remember one time that I started playing drums because he didn't get there to the second set. And I just happened my brother happened to have his own set of drums also, you know, as part of the equipment. So I was playing drums.
So you learned how to drum on the job. How'd you learn?
On the job.
How'd you learn to sing?
On the job. On the job, just by ear. I don't know how to read or write music. I just know how to, you know, if I hear something that I like, you know.
Well, how'd you start singing?
Just like I said, I was playing drums and my buddies wanted to come and see the orchestra. My buddies from high school, you know, I was still in high school. They wanted to go see the band. They said, well, y'all don't play no English music. Y'all just play Mexican music. I said, well, I told my brother, and my brother said, if you want it, English music, you sing it. So I was reluctant for a while, but I got the nerve to get a song and rehearse it and learn the words, and we took it to my brothers, and they, you know, backed me up, and that's how I started, you know, started singing one English song, then two English songs and more, and by the time you know it, I got in front of the bandstand. I was singing in the front instead of playing drums in the back, and by the time you know it, I didn't want to go back to the drums. I wanted to sing up front, you know.
So you were singing English songs in,
yes, ma'am,
in your brother's Mexican band. What songs were you singing?
Oh, like Blueberry Hill, Slipping and Sliding, and Tutti Frutti, and Little Richard, and all those rock and roll songs, you know.
How did Tutti Frutti sound with trumpets and saxophones behind it?
I think it sounded pretty good. You know, except for the singer. The band was a kicking, you know. Tutti Frutti, oh Rudy, Tutti Frutti. You know? And we try to, because a lot of those songs are from, like, black singers, you know. So they incorporated a lot of the horn section, too, the saxophone and the trumpet. So that we had that, so we could do it, you know. We couldn't sound like Little Richard, but, hey, we could more or less play a song where the young people could relate to, and we started getting real popular, or my brother's band started getting real popular, you know.
So how did you end up singing Spanish songs?
Well, as I got older, I got into the love of Mexican music, you know. How to interpret it, you know, and I found out what a lot of the words meant. A lot of the songs that I did in the early beginning 70s with my group, the Mexican Revolution, I didn't know what I half of the words that I was saying. You know, I was singing the words, I was saying the words, but I didn't know, you know, a lot of the words, what they meant. I was just singing what I heard, what I copied, you know. And as I went along, I started looking up words that I didn't realize what they're saying. Then I find out what they're really saying. And now, at my age, man, and it's a very romantic language to be singing, you know. And I started getting more and more into learning what words meant, what this Mexican word with a Spanish word meant, you know, instead of just singing it and not knowing what you're singing.
You said you needed to learn the meaning of the Spanish words in the lyrics of the songs. But Spanish was your first language, wasn't it?
Well, on my father and my mother's side, I did know how to speak Spanish. But you know, you don't cross words like red, R-E-D, red. I mean, I don't know what they were. Red is a net, you know. When you fall down from the sky, when somebody breaks, or you fall down from the sky, I will catch you with my red. And the way I sang a song, I was singing R-E-S, res. And res, you know what res is? Res is beef. It's cow. It's quite a difference, right? From a D to an S, res, red. And I didn't know any better. I was saying res.
And you were picking up the lyrics from other people, not from reading them.
Well, yeah, I think it's what it says, you know. And we would not take the time, or we didn't know any better to take the, what is he really saying? Or try to comprehend, what did you say on this? What is he relating to? We didn't know.
Are any of your uncles still alive, or your father?
Just one uncle is still alive. Out of the whole family, one uncle is still alive in Temple, Texas. He's 80-something.
How do you think he feels about you and your brothers continuing the family legacy of music?
He's very proud because he shows it. And, you know, up to lately, he's getting in his age, so he couldn't go. Every time we play in his town, Temple, he would go. Even just to sit down, he would go. And maybe he'd dance a slow song, but he's told me himself that he's very proud that you will continue the music.
Well, one of the similarities I can see between your adult life as a musician and your childhood life as a migrant worker is just being on the road a lot.
Yes, I think that's where I got the road in my body or in my soul, because I love the road. I love to move, and I think, I have the dream. Oh, the best of two worlds, like, is not this, not the way to describe it, but I have the best because I can get off the road and relax and my mama's house and, you know, just eat some soup and stuff. And by the time Thursday comes around, I'm kind of like ready to get on the road again, you know. And it's a great, I think I've acquired, in my perspective, whatever, the American dream, being my own boss, doing what I love to do, and I know when I got to do it and when I don't have to do it.
Well, I'd like to close with another track from a CD by your band, the Texas Revolution, and this is a song you wrote. Forgive my pronunciation. It's called "Mujer Sin Igual."
Mujer Sin Igual. Mm-hmm. Is that a good?
What's the lyric about?
Mujer sin igual is there's no other woman like you. There's no one that compares to you, you know, and, you know, you're exceptional, you know. I put you on a pedestal up here.
You're talking about me? No.
You. And
okay.
But that's basically what the song says.
Well, Ruben Ramos, thank you so much for talking with us.
Yes, you're welcome.
Ruben Ramos sings with the all-star band Los Super 7, which has a new CD called Canto. He also leads his own band, the Texas Revolution.
Yo quisiera volverte a besar y estrecharte en mis brazos, morena. Tus caricias con tanta ternura en mi mente las llevo grabadas. Tú eres una mujer sin igual, como tú
Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews a new biography of the celebrated racehorse Seabiscuit. This is Fresh Air. At the height of his career in 1938, the great racehorse Seabiscuit was the year's number one newsmaker, ahead of Franklin Roosevelt by several lengths. A new biography by Laura Hillenbrand called Seabiscuit, an American Legend, reminds us of why all of America in the 1930s seemed to be suffering from horse fever. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
If anyone had told me a couple of weeks ago that I would be raving today about a biography of a horse, I'd have snorted a resounding nay. But that's yet another wondrous thing about books. When they're good, they lift you out beyond the well-worn grooves of your own tastes and curiosities. Seabiscuit by Laura Hillenbrand does for the world of horse racing what Into Thin Air did for mountain climbing and The Perfect Storm did for, what was it, swordfish fishing? In daredevil prose that sprints along at a breakneck pace, Hillenbrand tells the incredible tale of Seabiscuit, who many believe to be the greatest racehorse of all time. Seabiscuit tore up the track for 5 years during the late 1930s into 1940. His story, and the story of the down-and-out men who joined together to uncover his championship potential, is an inspiring, extreme adventure tale of physical courage and moral grit. A tale that unfolded during a period when the whole country was living out an extreme adventure of its own, called the Great Depression. Seabiscuit, as Hillenbrand describes him, and as even a city slicker like me can tell from the many black and white photos in her book, was one sad sack of a horse. Runty and square, he had what Hillenbrand calls baseball glove knees that didn't quite straighten all the way. Sleeping and overeating were his favorite pastimes. When galloping, he often whacked himself in the ankle with his own hind foot. That was Seabiscuit as a 3-year-old colt before the supernaturally gifted trainer, Tom Smith, began working with him. Smith had learned his enigmatic way with ponies out on the vanishing western frontier, and he was famous for being a man of few words. Tom Smith, wrote one reporter, says almost nothing, constantly. Smith was 60 years old and living in a horse stall in a crummy Mexican racetrack when a man named Charles Howard hired him as a horse buyer. Howard had made a fluke fortune selling cars in San Francisco, but after the death of one of his sons, the grief-stricken Howard began frittering away his time at racetracks, where he met Smith. Smith, in turn, met Seabiscuit when the bargain basement colt and the mute trainer looked each other straight in the eye at a fairgrounds in Detroit, and both nodded. In an astounding roll of the dice, Seabiscuit's future jockey, Red Pollard, showed up penniless at those same fairgrounds just when Smith was ruminating on the choice of a jockey for the strange little horse he'd just bought. Pollard, statistically speaking, was one of the losingest riders in racehorse history, but Smith remembered some talent he'd once shown. The chemistry among these three washed-up men and the ultimate dark horse would become the stuff that dreams are made of. Like a brilliant jockey, Hillenbrand suspensefully manages her champion of a story. In the final stretch, the book hurtles towards its climax, the race of the century between Seabiscuit and the far and away favorite, War Admiral, on November 1st, 1938, at Pimlico. But before that race, there are fascinating and teasing narrative digressions. We hear about how the notorious Tijuana racetrack was destroyed by a moving mountain of horse manure, how the growth of radio spurred Seabiscuit's career, and how jockeys in the 1920s and 30s sweated, laxatived, and tapeworm themselves into thinness, only to find themselves broke and fired when almost inevitably they were crippled by riding. But back to the race of the century. Seabiscuit's jockey that fateful day was George Wolfe, subbing for a disabled Pollard. Tens of thousands of people were at the track. Everyone else in America was listening to the radio. Here, to give you a faint sense of how thrillingly Hillenbrand writes, is the pivotal moment at the end of that nose-to-nose race. Wolfe glanced at War Admiral's beautiful head, sweeping through the air like a sickle. He could see the depth of the colt's effort in his large amber eye, rimmed in crimson and white. An instant later, Wolfe felt a subtle hesitation in his opponent, a wavering. He looked at War Admiral again. The colt's tongue shot out the side of his mouth. Seabiscuit had broken him. Wolfe dropped low over the saddle and called into Seabiscuit's ear, asking him for everything he had. Seabiscuit gave it to him. War Admiral tried to answer, clinging to Seabiscuit for a few strides, but it was no use. He slid from Seabiscuit's side as if gravity were pulling him backward. It's always a toss-up in reviewing books whether or not to get into an author's life. A book should stand or fall on its own merits. Seabiscuit certainly does. So I'm not trying to give the book a boost by telling you that author Laura Hillenbrand was pretty much confined to her house by chronic disease all the years she was researching and writing her book. For me, knowing about her disease helps account for the dazzling energy of her race descriptions. In the pages where Hillenbrand describes Seabiscuit rocketing along at top speed, both she and her readers fly.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Seabiscuit, An American Legend by Laura Hillenbrand. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Mike Nichols talks about directing the new HBO adaptation of the Pulitzer Prize-winning play Wit. It stars Emma Thompson as a professor taking high-dose chemotherapy for stage 4 ovarian cancer. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.